Welcome to Beyond the Code, the podcast where industry experts and brilliant legal minds discuss the impact of new emerging technologies. I'm your host, Yitzi Hammer, a lawyer and tech enthusiast. Join us as we explore the legal, regulatory, and ethical issues surrounding AI, blockchain, and more. Get ready to go beyond the code and stay ahead of the game. Tal Mimran, welcome to the podcast. It's a great honor to have you here. You're a professor of international law, and I have a great passion for international law, both in the academic sense and in the practical sense. When I was a law student many, many years ago, I was very frustrated with how theoretical everything was, and I was struggling to find something in academia that has some kind of a practical element to it. And I found that the only two disciplines that I was able to relate to were international law, and I actually represented IDC, where I studied, in a international competition in international humanitarian law through the ICRC, and became very involved in, you know, writing and researching international law generally. And the other one was tax law. So you know what they say about taxes: there's only two things that are sure in life, death and taxes. So those are the two, I guess you'd say, like, practical disciplines that I connected with. But then when I graduated from school, everybody's like, you speak English? Well, you should go and do M&A law. So I didn't have much of a choice in the matter, and then ended up spending the past 10 years working with tech companies and doing M&A, capital markets, and whatnot. But I also have the privilege, and not many of my listeners know this, to have the opportunity to serve in the IDF reserves as part of their international law department, which I recently learned you were one of the founders of, and where you also currently serve. And so I thought today would be a good opportunity to hear a little bit about your background and your research, and specifically to explore a recent article you published on how the IDF uses AI in some of its operations and the international law aspects thereof. So without further ado, I'm going to hand the mic over to you for you to introduce yourself.
Perfect. So first and foremost, thank you very much for having me. It is my honor and privilege to join you today for this conversation. I will note, as per the anecdotes which you shared with me, that I agree that Mark Twain is a highly qualified publicist that we should follow. And I was actually a participant in the first ever ICRC competition in Israel. And wow. I coached for almost 10 years afterwards in three different institutions. So we share some similar background. I've been teaching and researching international law in the last 15 years. I'm the academic director of the Hebrew University International Law Forum. Until recently, I was the director of research of the Federman Cybersecurity Research Center, also at the Hebrew University. I'm a faculty member at Tzfat Academic College, and I'm heading a program that deals with digital human rights in Tachlit Institute. In the past, I used to work in the Ministry of Justice, representing Israel before human rights committees. As you mentioned, I was part of the founding generation of the operational legal advisors of the IDF, and I proudly served the unit for around 10 years, and they decided that I'm too old, or that the youngsters are better. And I've been involved in research also outside of Israel. I'm a member of several NATO working groups that deal with the application of international law to cyberspace, ERC groups, and etc. The topic that you want to deal with for me is the most fascinating, cutting edge, and novel issue that one can deal with in the intersection between law, technology, and war. And I'm happy to discuss with you the specific of artificial intelligence and also broader issues of the ability of international law to regulate technology and the advantages and problems that arise in this digital age, which seems like we are still in the beginning of, in terms of further evolution that is waiting around the corner.
So first, just use the term digital human rights. What does that refer to exactly?
So digital human rights can mean one of two things. One option, and the easiest one, is the application of human rights as we know them, freedom of speech, the right to privacy, and etc., in cyberspace or in the digital sphere. And the second option is new human rights, which apply in the context of cyberspace because of the unique characteristics of this new space. So, for example, the right to be forgotten is a new human right, which can be considered as a digital human right. But at the same time, all of the traditional human rights apply to cyberspace, mutatis mutandis. We need to examine the extent, the scope, and the way in which the rights are applicable in cyberspace. But as a general matter, I think that no one will contend that human rights have an important role in cyberspace, be it in business, in intellectual property, in terms of privacy, in balancing between innovation and other considerations, and also in the battlefield.
Okay, so you have this background in digital human rights, and you decide to embark on a journey researching the IDF's usage of AI in their various operations. Did you look at this specifically from an IDF perspective, or generally for how modern warfare uses AI?
So around a year ago, I went to a global summit called RIM 2023, Responsible AI in the Military Domain. It was a summit which hosted diplomats, the private sector, researchers, academia, civil society, and etc. And for 3 days, thousands of people met and discussed the ways in which artificial intelligence can and should be applied responsibly to cyberspace. And as I went back to Israel while sitting on the plane waiting to embark from Amsterdam to Tel Aviv, I opened the news in my cell phone and I wanted to catch up one last breath of the Israeli news. And I saw, to my very big surprise, that the IDF came out declaring very proudly that they are using AI in the battlefield, that it is leading the way. And the disparity from the forum in which I spent a few days. So it was very surprising. And actually, on the flight to Israel, I wrote my first op-ed on the issue, wondering why was it that necessary to come out with a declaration, and is it wise? Because on the one hand, it is clear that it serves needs like deterrence and asserting technological superiority. But at the same time, I was wondering, what is it a good call to come out in the open in such a fashion? Because other armies do not do that.
So your question was not whether or not it was okay to use AI, but whether or not you should be saying that you're using AI.
So that was the first issue that was of interest for me, because I was really curious. Will it be a step that will reinforce the legitimacy of Israel, or will it be just another rhetoric tool in the defamation of the state when it comes to its conduct of hostilities? And my concern was proved right, because 1 year later, we are in the midst of a war which we did not anticipate, and Israel is being blamed by deploying a mass assassination factory of death by algorithm, and et cetera, and et cetera. Very harsh allegations, which I find to be far-reaching and conclusory. But at the same time,
based on that initial statement saying we use AI,
that statement was the first of. Later, we saw several additional statements, and the IDF even invited foreign media from Bloomberg, Fox, and other outlets for a week to Israel, and invited them to look inside the war room, to look inside the AI systems, to see how things work. And in the beginning, the reports that came out from that initiative were more or less positive, one can say. But very soon, and especially after the current Israel-Hamas war erupted, the atmosphere and the nature of the discussion changed completely. And today, Israel is being blamed very significantly for its use of AI, for operating in a sphere which is not regulated by international law. And even a recent article blamed Israel for harnessing technology to exhaust the collective anger of the entire Israeli population for October 7th. So now it's not one war criminal, it's an entire society which harnesses technology in order to fulfill its wishes. So an absurd situation in which I find myself obligated to present a different narrative. So I took upon myself to write a series of articles. I wrote already 3 legal blogs, and I have one academic article which is now being evaluated by journals, which tries to present a more responsible view of the way that the AI is deploying artificial intelligence in the battlefield.
And do you want to elaborate, like, how, based on your understanding and your research, are the IDF currently using AI, and how does that fit into existing international law frameworks?
So, absolutely. The IDF is using AI in 3 main spheres of activity. Mm-hmm. So, first, AI is being used for defensive purposes. For example, for a border movement and for the Iron Dome system. In addition, artificial intelligence has a very big role in command and control, transfer of data, management of data, categorization, and etc. And the third sphere of activity is the offensive one, in which we have several platforms. The most known, or in the view of some, notorious, are the Gospel and the Fire Factory and the Alchemist, which also help in suggesting possible military targets for strike. And out of the entire scope of international attention, I would say that the offensive ones, or the later examples, are the ones which cause the most controversy. And we are actually now in the midst of a series of exposés of several articles which are coming out of the Israeli media, from 972 magazine, Local Call, which is an intertwined media outlet, which exposes every now and then new systems which are used by the IDF. But the problem is that those outlets publish articles and information without any person standing behind them. So there is no one witness or person who gives an interview who is willing to speak in his or her own name. And in addition, there is no official corroboration of the facts which are presented there. So those series of articles are now serving as a rhetoric tool in the battle of narratives in relation to Israel's way of conducting its battle in Gaza. And the situation is quite dire, I must say, because in the last article which I wrote and published in Opinio Iuris, one of the main platforms, sure, for discussion of international law in blogosphere, I was literally obligated to refer to 972 and to address the wild allegations which were raised in those articles.
With the obvious disclaimer that it was completely unbased on any official resource.
The only disclaimer by Opinio Iuris is that some of my statements relied on IDF, on self-interested IDF reports. So that's the atmosphere we are habiting.
So would you say that the IDF reports that you relied on were issued by the IDF unrelated to your counter-articles, let's call them? In other words, you didn't have anybody, mm-hmm, inside the IDF who was participating with writing your article and trying to give that other side of the narrative?
So we have a very wide spectrum of media outlets which reported on the topic. We have the big outlets like BBC, like Fox, like Bloomberg, the LA Times. We also have other domestic, less common, the Japan Times. I was interviewed by a newspaper in Italy, in Denmark, in China, and etc. So it causes a lot of international interest, and we have a lot of reports. But as it happens often in such situations, you have like an origin story which comes out of, let's say, 3 or 4 media outlets, and the others are just echoing the same message. So we have a battle of narratives, and the battle of narratives here is the question, well, is the IDF looking for more accuracy, for a better pace of operation? Can AI maybe help to better safeguard uninvolved civilians in Gaza? Or is it the other way around? Is the IDF indeed harnessing technology in order to deploy more significant harm in a wider extent and in a faster pace? And the truth, I think, is as always in the middle. It is not only one of those two possibilities, but I do believe in the bona fide of the programmers, of the officers in the IDF, and of the soldiers and the pilots which actually carry out the attacks, and in their desire to meet the requirements of international law, to meet ethical standards, and to avoid as much as possible harm to uninvolved civilians. But we must be cautious. We are entering a new and uncharted territory. Israel chose itself as an example. Israel sets itself as an example. Now, if you want to be an example where there is no benchmark, and if you want to sail in uncharted territories, you better do it in a very prudent way, especially given the international attention you receive.
So uncharted in the sense there are no existing regulations regarding the use of AI in military warfare, or in that there are regulatory frameworks that prohibit it?
So there is no regulatory framework which dictates how you should deploy artificial intelligence in the battlefield, but the situation is even more complicated because there is no tailored legal tools that actually deal with technology in cyber in the military sphere. So even cyber attacks is an issue which is under controversy because in the view of some states, mostly from the West, a cyber attack is one thing, but if in the view of other states, for example, members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, there is no cyber attack, there is an information warfare. So we can't even agree on basic concepts, such as a cyber attack, which is much more simple and basic when compared with the capacities of AI. So when it comes to AI, it is really no man's land in regulatory terms. There is no treaty, no custom. And the best that you can do is to take the existing general principles of IHL and try to interpret them creatively in light of these new phenomenon. So for example, I suggest that there is a need to maintain a human in the loop so long as the main standard based on which we are measured when targeting is the standard of a reasonable military commander. And since we don't have a standard of a reasonable military algorithm, we must maintain a commander within the loop. And you can also take, for example, principles such as distinction and proportionality and require programmers to entwine them into the decision-making process of such platforms. So that's the best you can do thus far.
But wouldn't you argue that whoever the programmer is who writes the program, assuming that they were a reasonable military commander, then that would be extended to the algorithm itself?
So the first suggestion is that when you program a platform that eventually one of its inputs will be a suggestion of a military target, then this platform must include IHL, IHRL, and other relevant applicable international law norms in its evaluation process. Secondly, this platform can never be the end of the line. It can never be the end of the process.
In other words, it can't run on its own. It needs to have some kind of human oversight at
Absolutely.
Some point.
Absolutely. It's a decision-making support system at best. Mm-hmm. You cannot rely on an algorithm to make a decision for you in the battlefield so long as you are measured by a human standard. So long as states will not decide on developing the law or developing their understanding of the law in a direction which will allow for autonomous decision-making in the battlefield, I would not recommend any state, let alone Israel, which suffers very significant criticism as a general matter, to try and pilot such an endeavor.
So if I understand from what you're saying, the optimal solution would be a semi-autonomous decision-making process where the AI is giving suggestions and then a human being is sitting there taking a look at those AI-generated suggestions and making a reasonable commander human determination based on IHL, IHRL, and you know, other international law principles, whether or not this is something that actually they should press the button on. Correct?
Absolutely. And I think that thus far, the IDF is not only doing that, it is doing much more than that. Because in the target room of the IDF, we have a lawyer and we have an intelligence officers which reevaluate existing information. We have engineers which evaluate possible collateral damage to objects. And we have different kinds of disciplines and expertise which sit together and evaluate the output which is generated by that AI platform.
Mm-hmm. I'm fully with you on where things are at currently. But looking to the future, typically in traditional legal frameworks, either legislators or courts determine the direction in which the law is going. But in international law, because the courts can often take time and be wishy-washy and not necessarily be respected by all state actors, academics have, in a sense, more of an influence on how international law is shaped. So, A, what would you suggest as the best way forward in making a more coherent framework for how militaries should operate vis-a-vis information intelligence? And number two, are there currently any forums or symposiums that are actively working to develop these regulatory frameworks?
So, generally speaking, we have a significant challenge here because cyberspace was not regulated for a reason. We have a disparity, we have a gap in ideologies, and we have a gap in capacities, which creates completely different perceptions of states and which distances states from one another rather than incentivizing them to come together and find a common ground. So, for example, states like Israel, the US, the UK, France, and etc. feel very well situated in the current climate because they are advanced in technological terms and because they have the capacity to move forward the international dialogue over the regulation of such technologies, while other states like Russia, Iran, and China view themselves as victims. They are victims of the system and they are being marginalized in terms of access to technology. Now, within such a reality, every state adopts a different perspective. So the West is satisfied with the situation as it is because we have the technology, we have the capacity to opine and to try to push the law in the direction that we wish, and thus we have no rush. We're in no hurry to try and promote any international treaty on the topic. On the other hand, and surprisingly, it is actually Russia and China and states which are members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which are interested in promoting new rules, a new treaty on cyberspace that will redistribute the wealth and will promote more equality, more inclusiveness, and etc. Now, this is not something which is limited to the cybersphere. Because if for example, you will look at the national myth of Iran, when we look at the 1979 revolution, we are looking at a state which fell under a political turmoil and was subject to a regime change. But from the perspective of Iranians, it was a pushback. It was a response to a reality in which the West was intervening in Iran and it had to respond. So it is a responsive act in their view. Now, the legal perception of those states will be dictated by this perception and by the way they view themselves within the reality. So a state like Israel will push for more leeway of action. Israel will want to promote a stance which allows, for example, cyber operations under the threshold of the law. On the other hand, states like Iran and China and Russia will lower the threshold of the law to be able to respond. So what Israel will view as an act which does not violate any law, say interference in elections to a certain extent or mass messaging and etc., Iran will see as a violation of sovereignty. So in this reality, we are in a very tough spot because polarization is on the rise, international armed conflicts are on the rise, and multilateralism is on the decline. So there is no international AI treaty, AI Geneva treaty, sitting on the shelf and waiting to be adopted. There is no international conference waiting for or inviting the international community to try and come to a common ground together. Now, those processes existed in the last two decades in relation to cyberspace. But sadly, those processes more or less failed, because we began with one type of a process, the GGE, the Governmental Group Experts, which was a very elitistic endeavor of 25 states in which you always have the P5 and in which the hegemony of the West was very well presented. And only after a few rounds of the GGE did the international community understand, well, we are maybe drifting from one another rather than bringing everyone closer to us. And then new processes like OEG, the Open-Ended Working Group, began to emerge. And international law or the international system tried to be more inclusive towards other states. But even if you understand and deal with this diplomatic and legal, let's say, deficit, you are still encountered with the difference in capacities problem. So what interest does a state like Israel have to regulate a technology which is a differentiating one? It gives it an advantage over its enemies. So what is the interest of Israel to limit itself and also to enable its enemies to take upon arms, which are also AI-based ones? So I'm not very optimistic, sadly, in this regard.
So it's the disparity between the East and the West approach to how these things should be regulated that are basically preventing them from getting to any kind of international consensus.
And those tensions have been with us throughout the development of international law, right? So statehood was impacted by colonialism, and self-determination was also impacted by colonialism. Every legal regime and doctrine of international law is impacted by that tension. How do you define aggression? How do you define an armed attack? How do you define an attack? So the difference of opinions between the West, which looks at kinetic damage, and between developing states, which see economic pressure as something which is parallel. So those differences and those tensions accompany us for many years. And the sad thing is, it seems like the gaps are growing.
And they will continue to accompany us for years forward. So in hindsight, after having conducted your research and publishing these papers, what kind of response have you got, both internally from Israel and from the IDF and also from other states? And just generally, what kind of feedback have you gotten from your publications?
So the IDF is actually very surprisingly open in this regard. And even recently, the IDF published an official answer to a letter sent to it by ACRI, by the Association of Civil Rights in Israel. Mm-hmm. And the IDF is willing to discuss these issues. But this is not the case around the world. So most armies which use AI will not admit it and will not talk about it. And for obvious reasons. Now, on the academic,
it sounds so unlike Israel to have gone out and made these statements.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it is proving itself as a challenging decision because it draws a lot of negative attention. And once everyone are already fearful or concerned or alarmed about something, you're going against
And you're heavily scrutinized in a field where you're already being heavily scrutinized.
Absolutely, absolutely. And on the academic sphere, well, the consensus is criticism. There is no doubt about it. Most scholars are critical about the desire to use AI in the battlefield. And I think that anyone who speaks in absolute terms is usually wrong, because nothing is absolute in life nor in law. So while I recognize that AI has a lot of advantages, for example, a common problem in a target room is that when you are in the beginning of an armed conflict, then the targets which you evaluate are the golden targets, very high quality targets with very high quality intelligence that was investigated fairly and etc. But as the conflict goes along, you see that the level of quality of targets which you face is decreasing. And it is usually in those later stages of the armed conflict where mistakes occur and where international legitimacy is running out because of those mistakes. Now, the AI can fix that, because the quality of the target which is suggested by the AI is the same regardless of the question if you are inside a conflict or outside of it, if you're in the beginning of the conflict or at the end of it. So it does have some positive aspects. In addition, the very same AI systems which eventually suggest targets are also used to manage and understand the area. So for example, when the IDF wants to evaluate in which parts of Gaza you have a large concentration of civilians, which you need to be careful about, then the AI systems, which are the decision-making support systems for attack, are the same decision-making support systems for protecting and safeguarding Palestinians. Because at the end of the day, they provide you, for example, with fast interpretation of imagery from satellite or drones. So it has advantages also for the other side, for your enemy, allegedly. At the same time, we need to be very, very careful about the introduction of those tools because of the problems which are inherent to the use of AI. So the problem of algorithmic bias is something which applies, of course, to AI-based tools in the battlefield. And problems like confirmation bias, the fear of over-relying on the AI system becomes much more dramatic in the context of the battlefield. Because you know yourself as a legal advisor in a target room, it is very hard to be the person who says no. It is very hard to be the person who is stopping an attack, and especially in a climate such as the one that we are in now, post October 7. So there are dangers of over-reliance, there are problems of bias, and there is the issue, of course, of lack of explainability of AI. So when you have a lack of explainability of AI and you rely on a recommendation which is not explainable and a mistake occurs, who is responsible? The programmer, the developer of the program, the operator of the system, the legal advisor, the military commander? And it also comes in the way of the ability to further investigate for operational needs. So investigations are not only a criminal matter. Investigations are needed for us to improve. We need to evaluate and reevaluate our operations. So when part of your operations is concealed because of the black box problem, then you have a problem to improve from time to time and to learn. So we need to consider all of those pros and cons, and we need to tread very carefully. And the IDF needs to be aware of the pros and cons and on the challenges and advantages in each and every step of the way, in the step of developing, in the step of deploying, in the step of training people. So you need to train people in technical terms, but also in ethical and legal terms. And also after operation, so post-deployment, you need to evaluate from time to time, is the system fulfilling its promise, or maybe it's the other way around.
And I would add one more thing, and I know it's not a popular opinion, but I typically I talk about this often in the target rooms. In addition to, you know, the ethical and legal considerations, like there may be a decision that you need to make that goes hand in hand with international law, and there's no legal issue, but having that human element allows you to bring in compassion as well. And sometimes, even though something is not wrong, it's also not right. So that's why I think that the human element is even more imperative. Just
I completely agree with you, and it is important that you highlight it because one can be lost in translation in between the rules and considerations and rationales, as I just did myself. And it is really important to be reminded that at the end of the day, you are correct, we are all humans, and without empathy, the road ahead will be very problematic, regardless of if we're dealing with war, with taxes, or with any other issues.
Thank you, Tal. One last question. So as I mentioned in the introduction, I recently learned that you were one of the founding members of the operational legal advisory unit that I'm very proud to be part of. And I'm not only proud to be a legal advisor, I'm very proud that the IDF even has such a unit that involves legal advisors at, you know, not every level, but at every material level, I would say. And I'm curious as to how the foundation of such a unit transpired and whether it was novel at the time, as I think it still is now, and you know, just what went into that.
So I was part of the founding generation of legal advisors. I was not serving in the military, so the credit should go to the MAG and for the visionary people within the system. But I was happy to help in the first processes, and I was also happy to recruit many legal advisors throughout the years. And I can say that it was very novel to begin with. And while some armies started to use operational legal advisors, some NATO armies, for example, I think that it is still beyond the reach of understanding of many people. So, for example, when I write about AI in the target room, so when I suggest that the legal advisor can take a recommendation from an AI and evaluate it and reject the recommendation, well, many European scholars are saying, but that's impossible. He will never argue with the machine. He will never be able to cope with the personal rage that he feels about the horrific act of October 7 and later apply the law in an objective fashion. It is beyond their grasp, and it surprises me. And even as I try to explain this notion time and time again, and the practice and the professional standards by which legal advisors work, and the role of ethics in the training of legal advisors, it is still something which they are unable to understand. And I think that it is very problematic, because a very beautiful enterprise, an enterprise which is dedicated solely for the promotion of more responsibility and also more empathy, like you mentioned, in warfare, is being perceived by some as a cynical, manipulative use of the legal profession. So instead of viewing the advantage and the important role of legal advisors in the target room, some exempt themselves from really looking into this phenomenon and suggesting, well, it is just a cynical use of their profession in order to further legitimize the aims of the IDF and et cetera and et cetera. So the situation is very, once again, Israel is always finding itself in a catch-22 situation. So if you admit that you do something, you are facing rage. And if you don't do it, then you are questioned why you are not doing it, and et cetera and et cetera. So this, let's say, this part of our destiny echoes also in this discourse. But it is definitely very novel and very important. And some of the doctrines and some of the rules which the IDF adopts as part of the work of the operational legal advisors and as part of the precautions in general, say roof knocking, is impacting some armies, especially NATO armies. So it's not all bad, but it is complicated, as always in Israel.
Tal, thank you. Thank you very, very much for your time and for that fascinating discussion. If some of our listeners want to get access to your writings and just follow you generally and learn a little bit more about what you do, what's the best way to find you?
Well, we all find ourselves in the toxic environments of Twitter and other social networks. But for me, I'm always open for discussion. Any person can always write, call, and contact. We can meet for coffee. We can discuss international law. I will be happy to invite you to my office in the university and to our sessions. So I have an open discussion, open invitation for discussion to whoever listens who is interested in further continuing it.
An email, something you could drop for people who want to reach out to you?
Sure. Talmimran@gmail.com.
Fantastic. Thank you, Tal.
Thank you very much. It was a very interesting conversation for me as well. I'm glad that we were able to highlight both macro and micro issues. And the questions and the way that you led the discussion was of great interest for me. And I'm really thankful for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tal.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Code. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe, share with your friends, and to tune in again next week for more fun and insightful conversations.